I'd like to call the Judiciary Committee to order. Today's Wednesday, March 12, 2003. It's just after 1:30 p.m. Present are Senator Ogun, Senator French, myself, Senator Seekins. And we're going to proceed on with new business with Senate Bill 45. And we have with us today the Honorable Senator Lyda Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Lyda Green. I'm a senator from District G, which is the core area of the Matsu Borough. And one of the functions that has proven to be a great help to the legislature in the past is the ability of our Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to get information and compile it and bring it forth to us and make recommendations. One of the things that has happened in the past is that there's been a reluctance, in some cases a near refusal of people who've been questioned to bring that information forward and to provide full information. Some employees have been told not to provide the information, and that gets to be a very difficult step for an employee to disobey the employer, even though they are by law required to participate with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. However, there are no penalties for that omission and withholding of the information. The bill that you have before you provides, in statute, first and second degree penalties for employees and our persons who serve on committees, are appointed positions who may not be considered employees, but they are public, have public affiliation. They are still required to provide full and truthful information. This just further shows the importance of that requirement. And in this bill is created a new section, Section 1156-870, hindering the Legislative Budget Audit Committee in the first degree. The next section, hindering the Legislative Budget and Audit in the second, and then provides for that information. The process in Section 2, on page 2, if a person has requested privilege and the procedure that they would go through for following through with the process of claiming privilege, and they would have to go before a judge and have that determined that their claim is complete and truthful.
Okay. I'd like to, the record reflect that Senator Terrio has joined us, and do we have questions for Senator Green? Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Green, your experience here must have convinced you that this law has been broken, or this proposed law that you're proposing has been broken in the past. Can you describe, I mean, I'm always just curious about sort of factual scenarios. Can you describe, without naming names, sort of how this law would be broken and when it's been broken in the past?
I can do that. I don't want to compromise anyone who, the person who shared that information with me. But it was kind of an awkward moment in that person's life. And one of the things that also happens with some of our employees in state government is that in addition to being public employees who were sworn to, we're all supposed to be truthful and ethical, who also have are licensed and certificated as either a certified public accountant and another professional, such as an attorney. When they're told not to provide, bring that information forward, there's another violation for them personally and professionally that's even greater than just the an employee of the state. Suffice to say, I was convinced that the information was true and complete.
And my other question is, why is this confined just to the Legislative and Budget, Legislative Budget and Audit Committee? Why wouldn't it be just as egregious if someone from the Finance Committee or from this Judiciary Committee was trying to get information on a bill and some state employee was discouraging or hiding information or not complying with requests made from a committee member?
I do not know if that is covered under another statute. I know that a committee member can. I always feel like the committee process is pretty compelling and that it's a requirement to come forward with the truth. I do know that the committee chair, with the concurrence, I think, of the presiding officer, has the ability to swear in witnesses. And if that's the mechanism one would use, if you felt like the information forthcoming were not complete enough. But I cannot speak to the fact that it might be a bad idea to extend it. I would not think it would be a bad idea.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, once I started thinking about that, I started thinking, well, you know, why wouldn't this sort of apply more broadly? Mm-hmm. Being a former prosecutor, I went to the statute books and I started looking around and I came up with, I think, five statutes that would cover different aspects of this problem, this sort of non-compliance or information hiding problem. And those were official misconduct, that's 1156-850, interference with official proceedings, that's 1156-510, tampering with a witness, 1156-540, tampering with physical evidence, that is if someone actually took a piece of paper and, you know, hid it under the desk so that someone at the employee couldn't find it, that's 1156-610. And tampering with public records, 1156-820. And so, looking at it as a former prosecutor, I thought it seems like there's some way to punish people who are actively subverting the public process with the statutes on the book. And so that was kind of one thought I'd share with you and see if there's something I'm missing and something that's special about the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee that really needs its own statute.
I'm sure Ledge Budget and Audit can speak to the purpose, but their purpose is so unique in state government, and it's the agency we rely on for oversight and review, and with either specific questions or a general direction or a suspicion that someone might have or just information to be gathered on the functioning of an agency or a department or a particular function being carried out. And there are requirements currently that you participate in the legislative budget. There's no penalty if you do not, or if you require and tell an employee they are not to participate and give full information. This provides a penalty, and it's loss of employment.
Excuse me if I'm wrong, Senator Green, but this is, we're saying hindering rather than, you know, and hindering has a little broader scope than hiding or destroying or defrauding. But this is where someone is deliberately setting out to hinder an investigation by LBA. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Senator Ogden?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Green, the penalty for hindering in the first degree is a Class C felony. I'm looking at 1156-610, tampering with physical evidence, which is, you know, a pretty serious crime. I think there were some cases in the Valley, I think, where that one person was murdered and dismembered, and you know, they spread, it was a teenager, a bunch of teenagers spread this body around the Valley, and it's a pretty shocking case. But I think the only thing, I think the memory serves me, they charged a lot of these kids with tampering with evidence, I mean, for... And that was pretty serious. So this, we have the same degree of felony for that, and I don't know. I guess I'm a little concerned at the what the ramifications of being a convicted felon for hindering the LBNA. It doesn't rise to the same level to me as hiding body parts of where somebody hacked up with a chainsaw like they did in the Valley. And whether or not that Class C felony. And to refresh my memory, whether or not you lose your right to own a weapon and right to vote and things like that with a Class C felony. I mean, felony is a pretty serious charge, and you know, so I guess I have a little bit of concern that it's a little tough. I know to misconduct of well, let me stop there, and then maybe I'll ask you another question.
Okay. Go ahead, Senator Green.
I think we have an expectation of when we require information about the finances, how programs are being run, or when our alleged budget and auditors go into an office with the sole purpose of finding out information, that the least we can expect is they be given full and complete and true information. And perhaps it does not rise to the occasion of other very heinous crimes. But I think if you were to review other white-collar crimes, you would find that they also are Class C felonies. And there is a comparable out there that may be in a different network of players and people. But that's all I can tell you.
Thank you. 1156-850, official misconduct. A person commits a crime or official misconduct of intent to attain a benefit or to injure or deprive another person. The public servant, you know, does a couple of different things. Knowing the act is unauthorized, does something that refrains from performing a public duty, and that's a Class A misdemeanor. I'm just wondering if making, I mean, I'm used to being lied to in this business by people, you know,
it's substitute.
Unfortunately, part of what this is about, you know, it's, I don't think we should condone it. I think the LBNA especially, I would think maybe if they, LBNA does have the power to subpoena, I believe, and if they lied under subpoena or something like that, that might rise it to the level of felony. But anyway, I'm just kind of thinking out loud and apologize for that.
There's also, Mr. Chairman, someone online who can probably direct some of the answers far better than I.
Is that Steve Branchflower?
That's correct.
Well, Mr. Branchflower, are you with us out there?
Yes, Senator, I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Senator Green has said you may be able to shed some light on the comments that Senator Ogun and she have made here in the last couple of minutes. Could you do that for us, sir?
I'd be glad to. I've heard a lot of good questions, and hopefully I have some good answers. I've been sort of taking notes and trying to keep up and simultaneously checking some of the statutes that Senator Fraser mentioned. And I was writing pretty fast. I managed to get multiple citations, but I may have missed a couple. But I will get back to that. And I'll also answer the question about what the present machinery is for dealing with this and why that's inadequate. But
okay, and if I could just interrupt you for a second, just so I don't forget, Senator Ellis has joined us, and I'd like the record to reflect that. Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Okay. Although I'm the director of the Office of Victims' Rights now, appointed just last year. For a number of years before that, I was a prosecutor here in Anchorage. And in fact, for a pretty substantial period of time, longer than I care to admit, almost 30 years. And over the course of my work as a prosecutor, generally, and specifically during the last 3 years, during a time that I was the director of the Alaska Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, there were a number of occasions where I either suspected pretty strongly or had positive proof that individuals within state government, in the case that I'm thinking of within the executive branch, instructed subordinate employees to either disregard specific requests made by the LBNA or to not cooperate. And in one instance, it was a pretty egregious instance, I decided to check the statute to see if there was a remedy to that, and I was disappointed to find out that the remedy was not commensurate with the seriousness of what was going on as I knew it. Now, one question that was asked is, exist, not only for the LDNA, but also for the entire legislature as well. It's a problem that's endemic to the system. There are a couple of statutes that deal with it, but they, in my view, are inadequate. For example, Alaska Statute 24.25 deals with, it governs subpoenas issued by the legislature. And if you look at that, you'll see that the enforcement mechanisms identified are limited to the arrest of the person by the sergeant at arms of the legislature and physically bringing the person before the legislature. That's in 24.25.040. And criminally prosecuting the person for disobeying the subpoena, 24.25.080. That, however, requires the cooperation and the initiative of the executive branch of government. There is no means that I know of within the legislative body to enforce those subpoenas. That's one problem. The statutes that Senator French mentioned, I want to just go and look at those, and I will say that at one point or another, during the time that I was working with Senator Green to put these statutes together, I looked at all of these, and I can tell you that while they are pretty sharp tools, that is, pretty efficient tools, none of them really addresses the situation that I experienced, that is, where behind the scenes conduct was engaged in by supervisors to discourage cooperation. For example, if you look at official conduct, which was, I think, the first one that Senator French mentioned, 1156-850, the problem is that what drives this statute, this criminal statute, is that the defendant, the perpetrator, has to act with an intent to obtain a benefit. And that can be difficult to show, because oftentimes the motivation of superiors within state government is difficult to ascertain. If it were something that were physical, if it were money or a gift or something like that, it might be easier. But oftentimes we have our low-level supervisors who are following instructions from before enforcing the will of or the pleasure of the supervisor. Their supervisors. So you have different layers that you have to work through. If it were a physical thing, it might be easier to prove, assuming that can be detected. 1156-540 is the split layer. Tampering with physical evidence. This deals with, like the former statute, deals with physical evidence. This criminalizes a defendant who tampers with physical evidence, like a bloody garment or maybe a check or something like that. What SB 45 is intended to reach is people who engage in conduct and bring to bear forces that they ought not to bring to bear in terms of persuasion and intimidation. 1156-610 is what I just talked about. There was another one. Oh, there's 1156-540, I think. Senator French also mentioned tampering with a witness in the first degree. The problem I saw is that what this requires is the pendency of a judicial proceeding, and that judicial proceeding is actually defined somewhere in statute, or I can find it maybe, so that absent the pendency of a judicial proceeding, you would not have a condition proceeding to charging someone with tampering a witness. The person's not a witness, but there's no judicial proceeding, which again is defined. The kind of conduct that SB 45 is intended to reach, again, are behind the scenes. You know, a supervisor calls an employee. Employee has told the supervisor that maybe they've got a call from the LDNA. They want some financial records, so they want a copy of an annual report or something like that. And the supervisor says, no, you're not to cooperate, no, you're not to provide that. That puts that employee, and this is what Senator Green is referring to, that puts that employee in a very precarious situation. On the one hand, should that employee cooperate, there's a risk that the person may lose the job. And while it's true that that person, that employee, may have some protection in terms of the Whistleblower Act, still it's going to complicate that employee's life very significantly, and that person will be marked, and the future of that employee is in doubt. There were some other statutes as well that were mentioned. legislature has provided to prosecutors are inadequate. Now, someone there made a comment, I think it was Senator Hogan, I'm not sure, comparing the tampering with witness statute and SB 41. The question was, well, what's the difference? The difference is that SB 41, as you can see, is divided into two halves. It's very similar to the criminal statutes that we have on the books. For example, the robbery statute consists of two parts, second degree and first degree. And a person commits first degree if he commits the second degree and certain other circumstances are present, for instance, the presence of a dangerous instrument or weapon and serious injury, that sort of thing. Same is true, for example, in burglary, where you have a lower level of burglary, where you have burglary of second degree, for instance, breaking into a non-dwelling within a warehouse that is increased in severity from a burglary second to a burglary first if certain things are present. For example, if the building that the person broke into was a dwelling or if a physical injury was caused over. Well, SB 41 does the same thing. It's broken into two halves. The, quote, lesser crime, which is the Class A misdemeanor, is called the hindering the legislative budget and audit committee in the second degree, and you can see what the conduct is there. The reason that first degree is a C felony is because it is aimed not at the conduct, but at the kind of person who engages in the conduct. The only difference between second degree and first degree appears on line 7 of page 1. If the perpetrator, if the defendant is a public servant, and that term is defined in 1181-900, then that person is culpable of a C felony. If you look at 1181-900, which is the criminal code, just look there for a second. Subsection 53 defines the term public servant very, very broadly, and it includes those people who would be in sort of a supervisory position. So the intent, the legislative intent between making the distinction between a misdemeanor and a C felony would be to to a greater degree, people who are supervisors who discourage their underlings or their people they supervise from cooperating. Now that's not to say that tampering with physical evidence is should not also be a C felony, but tampering with physical evidence deals with physical evidence. This deals with conduct on the part of supervisors. Additionally, this statute, SB 45, fixes another problem, which is, as I understand it, from time to time when the LBNA requests information from the executive branch, they are met with claims of privilege, you know, attorney-client privilege, doctor-patient privilege, whatever, and there is no mechanism present in the law to arbitrate those claims of privilege. So what happens is that the information is never passed on because there's no system to arbitrate the law. SB 45 sets out the procedure, and that's brand new. So just to summarize, SB 45 puts some teeth into the language of 242201 that gives the LBNA the right to ask for cooperation, full cooperation. But now, if it's passed, it would give an enforcement mechanism in the form of a new criminal statute. So I apologize for the length, but
that's a good question. So I assume now, based on that you've researched this pretty carefully, and in your opinion, is there any other statute that covers hindering an investigation?
I'll answer it by saying the following. When I had the one experience that I mentioned earlier, where it was very clear that a supervisor had instructed an employee not to cooperate, not to provide information, I looked at not only all of the state statutes, but I looked at the federal statutes as well. whereby I couldn't present the case to the U.S. Attorney's Office, but I resolved at that point that if I ever had the opportunity to fix this hole, that I would try to do so, and that's what I've done here.
Okay. And one other question I have now, in defining a public employee in this, the definition of a public employee here out of 3952-960, paragraph 20, is public employee means a permanent, probationary, seasonal, temporary, provisional, or non-permanent employee of an agency, whether in the classified, partially exempt, or exempt service. So that's a big enough lasso that it catches everybody?
It is. It's the lowest common denominator, so to speak. And the next level up, looking at it in terms of levels of supervisory, the next level up would be a public servant. That's the reason for use of a public servant in the first degree and public employee as you're just not referring to.
Senator Rogan.
Thank you, Mr. Branchflower. A Class C felony, what's associated with that
condition? In terms of penalty, Class C felony is the least serious felony. It is a non-presumptive felony. In the range, the possible range is zero jail time to a maximum of 5 years. There's also a provision for a fine. $50,000. I may be mistaken on that amount, but fines are very, very frequently imposed. Under our cases, a person who was a first offender who has no criminal history and is convicted of a Class C felony is essentially required to receive a probationary term as opposed to jail time, absent some pretty serious conditions, which, if present, would result probably in a higher conviction. Felony. So it's the least serious of the felonies. I don't mean to denigrate the consequences, and that's the reason that I inserted a provision in here that says that if a person, a public employee, if that person is convicted, he immediately forfeits the officer position, because my feeling is that someone who is convicted of that ought to immediately have nothing else to do with state government, independent of whatever else may happen to him in terms of.
And refresh my memory, does, along with being convicted as a felon under a Class C felony, what are the ramifications for voting, owning weapons, and things like that?
Well, usually what happens, at least in my experience, Senator French, I think, would share this view, people who are first offenders, and I think we're talking about people who would be first offenders because otherwise they probably wouldn't be state employees. So I'm going to assume that most state employees don't have any prior felony convictions. There may be some exceptions, but most of the time they're going to be first offenders. Those people not only get a probationary sentence, but they also get a suspended imposition of sentence. There may be some conditions attached to it, attend an alcohol rehab program or some sort of a rehabilitative program, abide by conditions of probation, make restitution, so forth. But at the end of their probationary term, what happens is that the conviction is set aside, and the person is restored to his status prior to the conviction. So that if he ever wanted if he's ever required to, for instance, fill out an application that says, "Do you stand convicted of any crime?" The answer, truthful answer, is no, because the conviction's been set aside. A lot of times, the application, depending upon what the circumstances are, the application is worded in a way to take into account those people who have had a suspended imposition of sentence. So the wording is a little bit different in order to capture the true conduct of what's happened. For example, I think in the state trooper applications, not only does it say, have you had any prior convictions, but it will also say, have you ever been convicted of a crime and had your conviction set aside through operational law, something like that. But again, the short answer is conviction for a C felony not only results in mostly probationary time, but almost always, at least in my experience, unless there's physical injury or something out of the usual, it results in a suspended imposition of sentence.
Senator Rogan.
That was a very skilled answer by obviously a skilled attorney. You didn't answer my question, though.
I'll try my best. Ahead. As far as the weapons?
Yeah, can a person convicted of a C felony lose their right to vote or lose their weapons?
A person loses their right to vote during the pendency of the probationary term, but assuming they get an SIS, then their right to vote, they have a right to vote. In fact, we have people who have had convictions where their convictions have been set aside and served on juries, grand juries and trial juries and so forth and so on. And as far as possessing weapons, if you look at the misconduct involving weapons section, which I think is in 1161, I'm not sure about that, there is a provision in there that takes into account people who have had a suspended imposition sentence. So the short answer is yes, they can possess weapons if their conviction has been set aside. That may be different under federal law.
Okay, but the other answer to that is yes, they can lose their weapons if their conviction isn't set aside.
If their conviction is not set aside, they, under state law, if they have a conviction, they may not possess concealable weapons.
Okay, thank you. It took a while to get there, but I finally got my answer.
Right.
Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, who is it that's testifying on teleconference?
Steve Branchflower. From who did the research on the bill for Senator Green?
I just want to. We've talked about who gets caught in the lasso. I just want to clarify for myself who can throw the rope here. It says the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee has the power to require, and here, entering the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And I'm just wondering, would this all be triggered only by the professional audit staff of the committee?
I see this working as a request is made, and if conduct that falls within the statute occurs, then what would happen is that it would be a crime just like any other crime that would be investigated by whatever appropriate police agency happens to be involved. Say troopers or municipal police or whatever, they would do their report and then they would submit it to the district attorney's office in that particular district. So the legislative branch could not bring a criminal action because that's a function of the executive, but it would all start in terms of reporting the crime. It would start on the legislative side.
Okay, but I guess I'm wondering, what triggers this? Is it, I was the chairman of Budget and Audit for the past 2 years. I had a committee staff person, but I had four people working in my office. Is it anybody in my office making a request, or does it have to be something that was actually approved by the committee?
Who made a request, assuming that they're operating within the normal course of business and the scope of their work, they made a request. Let me give you an example. Let's say you made a request to the Department of Health and Social Services, just to pick an example, and let's say that you wanted some audit report regarding Medicaid, and some Medicaid numbers and some effort was made to suppress disclosure of the information. Then what would happen is if the folks on your committee had reason to believe that there was some improper conduct going on, and there was no assertion of a privilege, what would happen is, I assume that, it would go up sort of the chain of command to you or whoever the head of the committee was, and you'd be apprised of the circumstances. You'd have the option of reporting that to some police agency for an investigation, and then it would sort of take place like any other criminal investigation.
But does it have to be something, you said the committee, like I said, I had staff that worked for me at my direction. They were paid out of the budget, not at budget. So if I just told my staff, well, call over to Hess and ask for this information, and my staff, my secretary, said they won't tell me, is that enough to trigger this whole thing, or does it have to be something?
So. I would think that you have to. Somebody would have to make a telephone call and make some inquiry and find out what the circumstances of the refusal were. It may may be that there's good reason or good cause. Maybe that, you know, maybe the request is not clear, or maybe the request has already been complied with. So I would, for me, I would say let's look into this a little bit more.
Okay, but you're not letting me ask my full question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So I, as chairman, any person that works for me, do they have the right to call over and demand information? And if it's not given, then it triggers this whole thing. How about just a person that's a member of the committee? Or does it have to be something, an action, that is approved by the full committee, like audits?
I see, okay.
When somebody, please stop, don't talk until I know my question. When LBNA approves an audit, the full committee approves that audit, and that kicks off the whole process by which our professional staff, who are bound by confidentiality, requests information and undergoes their work. Does it take that kind of committee action to trigger this whole thing, or can it be just a request by either my staff or any staff person to a member of the committee?
I don't think the statute answers that question. I don't know that question is answered anywhere.
How would you propose that question should be answered?
Well, if you look at 2420-201, which is already on the books, it speaks in terms of the legislative budget and budget committee having the power, as opposed to the independent committee. So I would analogize that, it has the power to require all state officials and so forth.
Well, and that's kind of fuzzy, and when the agency had the ability to just shine us on, that was one thing. But now if we're going to have some kind of a sanction, we probably need to clearly understand who has the power to trigger this whole mechanism.
Well, it may be that the conduct I'm trying to reach happens in such a way that it will become known to members, to someone who's not on the committee, and probably that's the way it will come about. It will come about on the part of some employee who has received a request for information. In my hypothetical, it might be someone who works within the Medicaid program, or somebody who works for HESS, who is the agency who has been requested to provide the information, and so the LBNA may never even know about it. And what this statute would permit would be the employee, in my hypothetical, to bring that conduct to the attention of the proper authorities, who would then investigate it.
Okay, and don't get me wrong. I think that we probably do need this sanction. I just want to be careful on when it gets triggered and who can trigger it.
Right, I understand completely. My concern was that these kinds of, in my experience, the kind of conduct that I'm concerned about does not occur openly. It occurs behind closed doors. It occurs between supervisor and the person supervised. And those are very difficult circumstances to disclose to anyone. They just it's not like you have a crime scene where you have physical evidence and people know about it. It's a very difficult time, a very difficult crime to even detect.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Green.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask Senator Terrio if perhaps he thought, and perhaps Steve Branchflower as well, if what this is really referring to is not so much the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee as it is referring to when a Legislative Budget and Audit auditor is proceeding to do the actual audit, and it has been authorized, and it's out of your control until you receive the audit back, because I would assume that they are primarily the one who would be doing the investigation, and that's not your committee, per se, is it?
It generally is the auditor, but Mr. Chairman, just to try and manage the workload, a lot of times if a legislator comes to the chairman, you try and deal with the agency without triggering a formalized audit.
Okay.
Quite often we would have the head auditor, or she would direct it to a person on her staff, make some inquiries to the agency and try and do it without going through a full audit request, approval by the committee. But it we did go to the auditor because they have they've dealt with the agency people. They have confidentiality, so there's an extra level of or protection for sensitive information if it's given to the audit staff.
Do you see a need to change the language to be more specific to the auditor?
I'm thinking that, and I'd certainly like to question Ms. Davidson about this, I'm thinking that if we go to actually have sanctions, that we might want to clean this language up to clarify exactly when somebody has to respond or suffer a sanction.
Mm-hmm.
To make it clear, it's not just the scheduling secretary that
that's
works
correct.
For the
That's correct. That's not my intention either. And I don't know, Steve may have an explanation that's far better than mine, Mr. Chairman, so if you just...
Branch Flower, any?
No, when I drafted this, what I had in mind was a situation whereby an audit was in progress and some information was requested by the LBNA and a specific order or command, if you will, was made to the employee not to provide the requested information and not even answer telephone calls, no emails, nothing, just to not to cooperate. And so it was in the context of an audit.
Okay. Can we just take a brief at ease? I just noticed and need to do a little housekeeping here that this is a CS for Senate Bill 45. And
Mr. Chairman.
Rogan.
I would move we accept the work draft /H as the Senate CS for the House Bill number 45 Judiciary.
Objection? Hearing none. We've adopted that one. Okay. Are there questions for Senator Green or for Mr. Branch Flower?
Just briefly, if I may. Mr. Branch Flower.
Go ahead, please, Senator French.
Is that Senator French?
It is. Hi, Steve. You said you thought about going to the United States Attorney with the situation you encountered, which was apparently someone thwarting a Medicaid investigation you were conducting. Is there anything in the United States Code that's my question. Is there anything in the United States Code that a U.S. attorney would be able to prosecute under their statutes? That is there a parallel U.S. code to the...
There are a number of obstruction of justice statutes, and there are even a couple of... there's one statute, I'm speaking of memory now, but if I recall, there was a statute that made it a crime to obstruct a health care investigation or investigation involving some health care crime. I looked at all those, and so the short answer is there are some tools there. I've always had trouble with obstruction of justice because the term obstruct is pretty difficult to define or quantify, and that's the reason instead of coming up with an obstruction statute, when I drafted this statute, I came up with specific conduct. It shows up on line 2 of page 2. Orders, discourages, threatens, and so forth, all of which amount to obstruction. But I thought it would be helpful and probably pass constitutional muster if we had some specific conduct. So, short answer is there are some federal crimes out there, but no problems with
it. And one other question, I think you and I see the sentencing under the C felony kind of the same way. That is, you get a first-time white-collar offender in front of a Superior Court judge, and the chances are that person is going to get a very short time period, 12 to 18 month SIS, meaning that if he or she obeys the law for the next 12 to 18 months, the conviction is set aside, and that person goes on his or her way. And so it just strikes me, and maybe you can correct me if you see it differently, but it strikes me that the chief sanction that's going to happen to a person that breaks this law is going to be that they're going to lose their state employment if they're a state employee, and their benefits and their salary and all that good stuff.
That's right. And that is a major concern to me because usually a supervisor will have some period of longevity with the state and have, frankly, quite a bit to lose. And once it becomes is known among supervisors that there are some teeth in the statute and that they do risk losing a career with the state, I think that they might think twice before, you know, following instructions from their supervisor or engaging in the kind of conduct that the statute disallows. So part of the reason for even having the statute is a deterrent effect that I think is planned.
If I could just ask one more question, that is, and you have to forgive me for belaboring this, but I like talking statutes with you, and I've got you here. going back to tampering with a witness in the first degree, 1156-540, I don't know if you have that in front of you. But,
I do. I'll pull it up here. 1156-540?
540.
Okay.
We were talking about that earlier, and I think my read of this is that a person commits the crime of tampering with a witness in the first degree if the person knowingly induces or attempts to induce a witness to testify falsely, offer misleading testimony, or unlawfully withhold testimony, which is kind of what it sounds like you encountered there, in an official proceeding. That's the operative kind of operative word there is official proceeding. Not judicial, but official. And when I go to the definition of official proceeding, back there in 1181-900, subsection 40, it means a proceeding heard before a legislative, judicial, administrative, or other governmental body. And so it strikes me that one place where a person who tells another employee to not hand over evidence or to not go testify or to testify, you know, to X when the situation is actually Y, where that person could be charged or try to be charged. That's just more of an observation than anything else.
There would have to be the pendency of some sort of a legislative proceeding under the definition of official proceeding. And oftentimes, by the time it gets to that stage where there's a hearing, it gets less likely that someone would hinder the work of that committee. The kind of conduct that I had in mind when I drafted this is, as I've described it, something that occurs well before, outside the scope of an official proceeding for the legislature.
As I understand it, also, this is Senator Seekins, Mr. Branch Flower. An audit really wouldn't be an official proceeding, and hindering that audit might be nothing more than saying, don't cooperate with these people.
Exactly. That was a circumstance that I encountered.
So then putting a burden on the underling that is in conflict with this statute. I'd like to ask a question, one more question of you. When I look at, and Senator Green as well, when I look at page 1, line 11, and it says, a public employee who is convicted under this section immediately forfeits the employee's office or position. In my business, we would also say, and is ineligible for rehire as a public employee.
I think that's a good observation. I didn't think about that. I would assume that somebody who, maybe the assumption is not well taken, but I assume that some public employee who's convicted of hindering a legislative budget and audit committee in the first degree, that's not the kind of thing that looks good on your resume, and I would assume that, you know, they would, that fact would become known and the person wouldn't be hired, but I think it wouldn't hurt to put that additional language in to make sure the person doesn't come back.
Sometimes strange things happen in the political world.
Yeah, that's right. I'm fine. Good.
And, you know, so I wonder if Senator Green would, is that a good idea?
Fine idea. That's fine.
All right, Senator Rogan.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Branchflower, I'm sorry. When you became aware of this, what actions did you bring before LBNA? Did you ask them to subpoena them? Did you ask them to hold a hearing and bring these people forward? Couldn't an auditor do that under these circumstances and they could subpoena them or put employees under oath?
Not without the employee risking hiring, especially if employees serve at the pleasure of the commissioner. There are a number of employees that serve at the pleasure of the commissioner, and Senator Green was talking about. The choice is, you know, people who have families and financial obligations are more apt to agree to follow the specific instruction of their boss and not take any action, especially if they're an at-will employee, rather than take the valiant step, which is to defy the specific instruction and be right but be dead right, you know.
Well, on that point, it seems to me that if you know, we have, I'll be an A chairman here, or former one, and it seems to me that if the chairman felt that there was some shell games going on, he could get that employee or get the employee supervisor before the committee and say, okay, raise your right hand, put him under oath, and say, I want to know why, you know, what the issue is here. I mean, I guess some there seems to be some other modalities in law that maybe we could work under a different chapter or something. I don't know. I'm just I don't think it just seems to me that there was a modality there to deal with this kind of thing, and it either wasn't done or something. But now we want to make it a felony, and I don't have a problem with people losing their job and ineligible for rehire or something like that, but I mean, wasn't there some kind of a modality that the chairman could have done something and called these people forward and put them under oath?
Well, the problem for especially at-will employees is that once the instruction is disregarded, that effectively has the very real potential of ending that employee's career, regardless of how the audit turns out. And the problem for the employee is that it places the person in a position of having to make very, very difficult choices. And more often than not, the employee is going to err on the side of preserving that person's job. And what that means is that the information sought is never going to come to light. And I think this goes on. I know it goes on. And so you'd never get to the stage where the chairman of some committee would say, okay, I know about this attempt at hindering or this attempt to obstruct me getting this information. I know that it went on, so now I'm going to take the step of issuing a subpoena and we'll bring somebody in and have to take the oath and so forth. But by the time it gets to that stage, the cat's out of the bag and that will employee is already at risk.
Okay.
Senator Owen, go ahead.
So your answer was yes, there is that modality. See, this is kind of, you're kind of making my point. I'm asking a question, a specific question. You're kind of giving me good answers, but they're not quite roundabout. I mean, I don't think there's any culpability to not answer my question. And in an audit, it's the same kind of situation. There's lots of gray areas about questions and answers. And when do you get into, you have to have a culpable mental state to be convicted of a felony, that you deliberately had a certain type of behavior, and you know, it gets kind of subjective in this realm of politics we're in, and what's the right answer. You know, I mean, I don't always like the answers that people give me, and sometimes I think they're the wrong answer because I didn't like them, you know. I mean, so I don't know. These are some major ramifications here, committee chairman have a lot of power, and the power to subpoena, and the power to put people under oath, and there's serious violations. Well, not as serious as this, but there's violations for ignoring that. So, anyway, I guess that's a statement more than a question.
Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, it seems like we've got two different things. Two different scenarios here, and I agree that it's a problem if the at-will employee just... If the supervisor tells the at-will employee, don't cooperate with them, they may be the only two people that are privy to that decision. So if all of a sudden the chairman of LBNA starts calling the supervisor up to ask them to take an oath, the supervisor's going to know who leaked the information. And so we've put that employee at risk. I think the way to get around that has been suggested to me is offer that employee some whistleblower protection. That if they feel like they've been boxed in and been given instructions by their supervisor that they don't want to follow, give them some whistleblower protection. We've got that type of statute at work elsewhere. that language at work elsewhere, and maybe you can just make a reference to it. I don't know, structurally. But you also have the scenario where maybe the supervisor and the employee, they're working in conjunction. They get together, let's do this, and thwart them. And then maybe the only way to get to the bottom of things is for the chairman to call people forward and have them raise their hand and swear. So you've got those two different possibilities, one where an employee is being asked to do something against their will, but you also might have a situation where the employee is just fine with thwarting the efforts of the auditor. And it seems like it might be sensible to make all of that applicable when there's been a request through the operation of an official audit being done. There's just a very brief conversation with our head auditor. She said the informal requests that the chairman uses, again, to try and manage the workload so that not everything goes through a formal audit process, just the formal, hey, Pat, can you have your shop call over there and just see if you can get an answer to this question. We perhaps don't want to have this proposed section of statute apply to that, but when you get into a formalized audit, then maybe we want to have all these sanctions then kick in for public employees who are thwarting the will of the committee. And the other extra twist on that is it says, you know, at the specific direction of the committee, and the committee does take action to approve audit requests. But we also have in statutes a number of audits that are triggered by statute, not by action of the committee. It just says the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee shall, once every 2 years or once a year, perform X audit. And we would want this mechanism to also apply to that. So
sunset audits as well?
Sunset, financial audits, some of the things that are just triggered by the operation.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Comments? Senator Green? We do have someone here from our audit division. Did you want to provide any testimony for us today? Thank you, Senator Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Davidson with the Division of Legislative Audit. I actually did not have any prepared testimony. I did want to make sure that the committee knew I was available for questions. I was very interested in listening to all the testimony, as we are the people that have to conduct the audit. I've known the weakness about having a statute that requires agency cooperation, but then no enforcement of that. There's a lot of different avenues statutorily that could be pursued to encourage and put little teeth behind that encouragement. And so for the most part, I was here mostly to listen in terms of not only the sponsor statement, but if, I don't know if the Department of Law or any agency had any testimony to hear in terms of the practical application of this, in terms of how it's going to actually play out during the course of audits.
Okay, you know what, Pat? I have a habit of calling in at ease after 1 hour in a committee, even though we've had a quick one, just for a quick break for anyone that needs to excuse themselves for a minute. And if you just hang on with us, we'll come right back in about 3 minutes. At ease. Pat, we'd just like to have any of your comments, because our intent at this point is to roll some of the ideas that we've talked back in with Senator Green and come back with a CS for further discussion. We get to a certain point, we get a certain amount of weight, we got to come back with a clean sheet of paper. And so any input that you could help us with at this point would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Listening to some of the testimony, one of the questions asked, was there any particular instances? I don't know what Mr. Branchflower was specifically addressing. I have been the legislative auditor over the last 5 years, and I only know of one occasion where I had conversations with the chairman of the Budget and Audit Committee regarding the potential need to issue subpoenas for an audit because of non-cooperation. As committee members have mentioned, non-cooperation, there's a gamut of non-cooperation for a lot of different reasons. And luckily, I have very trained staff. We have real good sort of detectors on when that's going on. So there are instances, and having the LB&A committee subpoena power as a backstop has always been an important element in ensuring or helping get cooperation. The other thing that I heard is the discussion about differentiating the actions of a supervisor to an employee where the employee wants to cooperate. Looking at it, and probably the attorneys and Ledge Legal probably have a keener understanding of the implications of it, but I look at it as you want to encourage everybody to cooperate. And if by specifically identifying in the whistleblower's statute, and I'm afraid I don't know that statutory reference, cooperation with the LB&A committee or the Division of Legislative Audit is specifically covered, as opposed to them wondering or even asking us whether it is covered, might be helpful on the positive side. And then in terms of trying to look at that supervisor who is taking that overt action of trying to hinder, there's a gamut of remedies. I've heard the discussion here about felonies. Other avenues would be Executive Branch Ethics Act, violation of that. Having the troopers to come and investigate if it's a felony, how likely are we to get the troopers to come in and actually do that, as opposed to how likely is it that we could get the Department of Law to move on an Executive Branch Ethics complaint. Those are the things that I really don't know, but I would expect that the committee would like to hear some more about.
All right. Any questions? Senator Thero.
Mr. Chairman, just one other thing, too, that we've got the audit staff here, but Ledge Finance also is a branch that is under budget and audit.
Right.
So we probably should have Mr. Teal weigh in on this issue, too, to see exactly what kind of interaction his finance folks have with state agencies, and how we might shake the statutes here thinking that it just applies to the auditors,
right,
but staff to the committee is also the Ledge Finance shop.
Okay, we'll do that. So as I understand it at the moment, we're going to take a look at a couple of things like who throws their open when, you know, kind of a, as Senator Thero has put it, some whistleblower protection that's out there for someone who may need that in order to get the complaint filed, and looking at whether or not we want to continue with this as a felony or if we want to make it a misdemeanor, and also adding in whether the employee who's dismissed would be eligible for rehire. So those are the things that we'll concentrate on, and anything else, if you will, we'll work on a CS for down the road. Senator Ellis.
Chairman, was there anyone from the Department of Law signed up to testify to give their perspective?
I did not have anyone, but we're going to
we'll request.
Mr. Hove is going to request someone from the Department of Law next time. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Pat. We appreciate your help and continue to help on this. We want to make sure that you get the best information you can to bring it back to us.
Appreciate it.
All right. Let's move on to number two under your tabs, and this is the SJR 5. Tom Wagner is the prime sponsor, and we have Mr. Wagner's trusted staff person here. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Amy Seitz. I'm staff to Senator Wagner, who wanted to be here but had another meeting he had to get to. When the Brady handgun bill was adopted, it established an instant check system to ensure that individuals with a criminal background could not obtain firearms. Records of those individuals who are disqualified from purchasing firearms will have a permanent record on file. However, if an individual is approved for purchasing a firearm, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System is supposed to destroy all records of that individual except the transfer number and the date of the transfer. The Federal Bureau of Investigations has decided to keep these records for audit purposes, which is against both the letter and the intent of the Brady handgun bill. The intent of the measure before you today is to urge the President of the United States and Congress to prevent federal agencies from maintaining these records. And also it requests that statutory changes be made that so this doesn't happen in the future. And with that, I'll answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Amy? Hearing none, is there discussion?
Mr. Chairman, actually, yes. Could you just perhaps highlight the changes?
Let me do this one other thing, too. We're going to adopt this. We'd like a motion to adopt CS/I.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate CS for joint resolution, MAC/I version for the bill before us.
Okay. Objection? Hearing none, that's where we are.
Mr. Chairman, could we just have Senator Wagner's staff highlight the changes from the original bill to the State Affairs CS?
On page 2, line 9, after the United States 2, the original version said prevent, and in the CS it's changed to ensure. And then after federal agencies comply with the law prohibiting them was added to the CS, and that was a wording preference.
Thank you.
Senator Ogden.
I just want to state for the record that I really believe that the Second Amendment was the first Homeland Security bill. And I'd like to see, tempted to tinker with it and maybe say that we should allow these people that have these instant background checks to carry weapons on planes to repel terrorists, but I won't go there today.
Thank you, Senator Ogden.
Preview of things to come.
Any other questions? We have a motion. Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the CS for Senate Joint Resolution Number 5, the State Affairs version, be passed from the committee with the zero fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Objection? So ordered. On to tab 3, SJR 8. And Mr. Hull, would you do us the pleasure of the sponsor statement on this?
Certainly.
And we're going to be looking at Senator's resolution /D, and it's the original. So,
for the record, my name is Brian Hove, committee aide for Chairman Seekins. SJR 8 deals with the splitting of the Ninth Circuit Court. 12 days ago, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a controversial decision which essentially declared the Pledge of Allegiance unconstitutional. This ruling clearly demonstrates the disconnect it has with Alaska. Senate Joint Resolution 8 respectfully calls upon Congress to divide the Ninth Circuit Court. This action is necessitated for a variety of reasons, not the least of which includes the vast geographic and philosophical differences between Alaska and the San Francisco-based court. Circuit Court adjudicates a caseload far beyond that which is reasonably manageable. In total, there are 11 Circuit Courts of Appeal throughout the country, yet the Ninth Circuit Court oversees nearly 20% of the U.S. population. In other words, the Ninth Circuit is twice the ideal size. This size disparity is cited as the principal reason for the Ninth Circuit Court's relatively high reversal record in cases heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. SJR 8 endorses legislation previously introduced in Congress by Senators Ted Stevens and Frank Murkowski. This legislation would reconfigure the Ninth to encompass Arizona, California, and Nevada. The proposed new 12th Circuit Court would take in Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington. Similar legislation was recently introduced in Congress by Senator Lisa Murkowski. SJR 8 simply seeks to accomplish two objectives. One, to correct a considerable imbalance in the Ninth Circuit Court's caseload, and secondly, provide the disparate regions falling within the Ninth Circuit Court's current purview with a better informed panel of judges. These objectives are best accomplished by splitting the Ninth Circuit Court. On behalf of the sponsor of this resolution, I appreciate your kind consideration and welcome any questions.
Questions? Senator Ogden.
Thank you. I guess splitting the court isn't going to necessarily make the judges better. If they're there for life, just have to say that, since you mentioned it in the statement, that the One Nation Under God portion of the Pledge of Allegiance, I'm always perplexed at why judges, or a lot of judges, especially these guys, seem to look at the portion of the First Amendment that says, the establishment clause of the First Amendment that disallows establishment of religion, but they seem to totally ignore the second part that says, nor prohibit the free exercise thereof. So it seems to me that ruling, I know this resolution isn't about that ruling, but maybe that might be some of the catalyst for doing it. But
exactly.
So I guess I wish splitting the court would get rid of some of those judges, but I think attrition's going to have to take care of some of that. Fortunately, we have hopefully a U.S. Supreme Court that'll overturn them once again. And that brings me, I guess, my question. Do you know right now what the running tally of cases overturned by the Supreme Court, by the Ninth Circuit cases overturned by the Supreme Court? You said it was relatively high. I would say it's extremely high. Last time I counted, it was like 29 out of 31 or something like that. And I'm not sure if any more have been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court that have been overturned. Do you happen to know the current number?
No, I was being kind. I do not know the precise number.
I would say it's extremely high.
Yeah.
But again, splitting the court isn't going to get rid of those judges, so unfortunately.
I think it may give us an opportunity to play a little larger role in the process, though.
I agree.
And you know, whatever we can do to that extent is certainly to our benefit.
Just, Mr. Chairman, if I might, just state for the record, right. I did attend a hearing at the Ninth Circuit a couple of years ago with Katie John case, and found it pretty fascinating.
I know, Senator Ogden, as is on line 23, page 2, the Ninth Circuit was reversed 5 of the first 6 times it was reviewed in the October 2002 term. And one of the things that we are very concerned about, and one of the reasons that we propose this, is that a Ninth Circuit judge cannot attain necessary familiarity with federal legislation affecting Alaska, because a Ninth Circuit judge may only sit on a panel of Alaska once every 10 years. So it's hard to get any continuity for a little state like this when it's, you know, with that number of cases and that number of judges and justices, because at an extraordinary size, no one ever has a chance to build up any familiarity with the federal laws that affect the state of Alaska. So it's very difficult, as we all feel that frustration. Other questions for Mr. Hove?
Do you have any testimony from anyone in the audience? Testimony? Yes, Senator Ellis.
Do you know how many judgeships are currently vacant on the court? Did you state that?
No, I don't. I don't have that information for you, Senator Ellis. I can get it if you so desire.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Hearing no other testimony, do we have a motion? Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Joint Resolution Number 8 be adopted by the committee by individual recommendation.
Objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Tab 4, CS House Bill 12, and we're looking at version/Q.A. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's good to be here, and it's good to see our friend Senator Ogden. He and I served on the House Judiciary Committee last year, so it's good to see you back on the Judiciary Committee. Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, before you, House Bill 12 lists as one of the methods of harassment electronic communication. Our current statutes do not allow for electronic communication as a means of harassment. And this has been a problem for our law enforcement agencies. In fact, you should hear from some of them today. With the low cost and ease of access to computers, more and more harassment is being done via the computer and electronic communication. An individual who may not want to confront a person personally or on the telephone may feel very comfortable doing it via the internet or email. In fact, some people are so good on the computer, this certainly isn't me, but they can program their computer to just automatically send these harassing messages at regular intervals, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Online harassment, or harassment in general, really isn't a serious crime. It's annoying, but it often is a prelude to more serious crimes. So the sooner we can catch this, the better off we are. It's a relatively new problem for our law enforcement agencies, but yet it's one that is growing as we have more and more people getting access to the computers. The challenges that the law enforcement folks are having with this, and like I said, they have been catching people who are harassing via the internet, but there's nowhere in our statute now to prosecute these folks. They approached me last summer with this frustration, and hence that's why we had this bill in front of us. This bill has evolved through the House relatively quickly, but there was a couple of amendments that were made. One was in the House Judiciary, they felt like it was necessary that we put a letter of intent as to what we felt like electronic communication was. We talked at one time trying to define it, but that was too difficult to define in statute, so we just did a letter of intent and kept the definition fairly broad and one that could evolve with electronic communication itself. And then the second minor amendment was made on the floor by the minority leader, and that was to add the word sexual contact. And I think you'll see that in the bill on line 14. We had quite a bit of debate about that. I felt that line 12, where it says an obscene electronic communication, would cover sexual contact, but we have quite a few lawyers now in the House, and they each pulled out their different definition of obscene, and we just felt like it would be more, we'd make sure that we had it covered if we also included the word sexual contact. It doesn't change the bill, and if anything, it just reinforces and makes the bill stronger, so we accepted the amendment. And Mr. Chairman, that is the bill, and I encourage passage.
Senator Ogan?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill number 12, in the judiciary version, be /Q.A.
Objection? Hearing none. Senator Terrio?
I'm always a little bit leery of stuff that's done on the floor. Did you get any kind of memo back from the drafters cautioning you on the use of that wording as it appears before us?
Let me ask my staff. I think she was with the drafter. Apparently, she has been in contact with the drafter of the legislation, legal services, and there was no problem with that amendment.
Other questions? Senator Ogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. See you, Representative Meyer. The issue of electronic communication, obscene electronic communication, is one I think that all parents grapple with because the exposure of their children to the internet and some of the dangers and the traps that are there. And I think often, I've always been concerned that about like unsolicited obscene material, because I think everybody that's been on a computer for any length of time has either unwittingly or without any even trying, found themselves in some kind of a site that's obscene. I know I have. And and I'm very concerned that this is a snare that's used by pornographers to snare our children into antisocial behaviors and behaviors that are destructive to their their moral fiber and who they are as people. I would wonder if, this is a vehicle that we might be able to work on some of that.
Senator Ogun, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we do have a bill, House Bill 82, it's currently scheduled for Labor and Commerce, that deals specifically with unsolicited sexual explicit material.
Okay, great.
And it's basically going to make it illegal unless they put in the subject line that it contains adult material. Then that way, our kids will know not to open that, or better yet, you can set up your computer to filter out that word adult, and so that our kids won't even get that type of stuff, because I know exactly what you're talking about. But this one just deals strictly with harassment, and again, just putting harassment as electronic communication as a means of harassment in statute, so that when people are sending out emails saying, I want to kill you, or threatening things like that, our law enforcement agencies can do something about it. Right now, they can't.
All right. Other questions for Representative Meyer? We have Kurt Harris on the line for the Alaska State Troopers. Are you there, Mr. Harris?
Yes, sir, I am.
Please go ahead and address the committee.
I don't have any specific testimony to provide. The Alaska State Troopers are supportive of this legislation, and I'm available for any questions that anyone may have.
Any questions for Mr. Harris? Senator Ogun.
Yes, sir. Do you have people that have the training that can specialize in the electronic crimes now that are being passed on people? And in other words, do you have somebody that's a resident computer whiz that is able to detect this type of thing and trace it to where the origins and all that other stuff that people with much better minds than I and this type of thing do?
Yes, sir, we do. The Alaska State Troopers addresses that through our white collar crime section, which is a portion of the Criminal Investigation Bureau. I have obtained that training. I have quite a bit of experience in that, and we have two other investigators in the unit that are coming up to speed with that capability.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Senator Terrio. Chairman, I move CS for HB 12, Judiciary Amended, from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal notes.
Objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Mr. Meyer.
Thank you.
Representative Meyer. Is there any other business that needs to come before this committee today?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ellis.
I just note for Senator Ogun that I also am a sponsor of legislation on unsolicited spam email of various kinds that clog up small businesses and private parties to the tune of billions of dollars a year. So that may be something we also want to consider.
Thank you. Anything else? Hearing none, the committee meeting is dismissed, adjourned.